What I think is now widespread recognition that we don't yet have the solution in place to tackle our housing crisis. The last figures that we have are roughly that we built 125,000 homes over the last 12 months. We know that just to hit parity we need to build 250,000, and we haven't done that for many a decade. One of the things I think that particularly emerges from the report is once we've taken councils out of UK house building, nobody has stepped up to fill that gap. Housing associations at most, or at average, can build about 15,000 homes a year. But councils from high points, I think in 1968, it was over 320,000 homes were built a year. I mean, not all of them were beautiful, many of them were ugly and utilitarian, and part of that we need to change, but they were crucial in actually building to scale. So what we did with our partners, and again to reiterate what David's already said, we're enormously grateful to them, we really tried to get to the heart of why we can't build to scale, what's gone wrong. And I think what's emerged, and we found this at Res Publica across the piece, is we have such a fragmented policy regime now that it's very difficult to do anything, you know, from the NHS to house building, even to kind of more rarefied areas of public expenditure such as defence. Everything has got so fragmented, so extended, there are so many players that you actually lose the ability to control and shape. And at different parts of the system can declare UDI effectively against other parts of the system. And what we've had is largely a series of demand-led innovations, many of which were welcome, many of which were also equally feared. I'm thinking of the National Planning Policy Framework. But none of them has really created the acceleration that we need. So what we believe is that actually it's important to gather all of these different barriers, all of these different problems into one single place. One new institution that has a single decision point, a single point of transparency, that gathers all of those who have a stake in housing and going to scale under, as it were, under its auspices. Now, part of, I think, the merits of what we propose in our Devo Home is that actually we should include residents, we should include civil society groups, because much of the resistance to new build, much of the NIMBYism is a resistance to bad design, poor quality homes, and homes built without the necessary social or indeed hard infrastructure, from roads to hospitals to schools to green space. And in addition to that, what we felt would be important is creating councils not necessarily as deliverers but as enablers, as market makers and as place shapers, as coordinators. And we wanted to create an environment within which all of those who have a say, who traditionally veto one another, who traditionally try to operate against one another, in the same space so that we can create common outcomes that all people share in and all people commit to. Now, one of the things that this allows, for example, is the capture of land value, which we've never managed to do outside of big infrastructure projects such as Crossrail, and even then through very kind of several times removed. I mean, very few people who had the rate levy on them would realise that it was a form of land value capture, although it was. What we want to use is we want to use this land value capture to on homes that are built under the auspices of these new local place partnerships to help fund some of the social infrastructure, some of the affordable housing, and some of the financing for what creates a community. We also recognise that actually if you can create an instrument that's understandable, that's clear, that is repeatable and replicable across the country, what you do is you create a new mass investment vehicle for external and internal finance. And we argue in the paper for not just local authority pension funds, but the municipal bonds. But also what we'll create is a way in which investors, international investors, can invest at scale into an understood format. Whereas at the moment, things are so bespoke with multiple versions of joint ventures that they're too particular and too small to attract that sort of investment. And we feel that with balancing the demand side and actually trying to create aesthetically beautiful places where people genuinely have a say, where we have developers who are bought into that, not least because if opposition is turned from opposition to something that supports the project because it genuinely adds social worth, together with all the players, you actually then create the conditions for something genuinely transformative. And if you add in the land assembly powers that we argue for, so the devolution of public land from the Homes and Community Agency to these place partnerships, then you actually have a mechanism that can genuinely go to scale. We know that I think it's 28% of all public land, of all land, is still held in public, 40% of brownfield sites. And I think there's also scope to build on these ideas and start to think about, could we even give further land assembly powers to these partnerships, which would, of course, operate across local authority boundaries and would enable us to say, in this place here, these are the needs of this area, and this is the vehicle that can deliver on those housing needs. Now, in some areas, in places like Liverpool, for instance, there's a surfeit of housing. There's too much of the wrong type. There's too much for past industrial models that needs to be cleared, and different types of housing is built. So we think actually that this is a vehicle not just for the southeastern economy, but it's a vehicle that also can help transform the northern economy and rebalance those our great northern cities. We will also fold this in with all of our devolution work at Res Publica that you will know that we're leading on across the United Kingdom. And we'd very much appreciate your further thoughts on what new other powers we can add and how to make this work so we can create a model that genuinely can go to scale. Because we know we're not going back to the old council model, but hitherto we haven't got a model that can genuinely build the remaining 50%. So without further ado, there are hopes for the project, and I'll turn with great anticipation to Roberta Blackman-Woods, the Shadow Housing Minister. Roberta, pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Philip. Actually, what I think you're going to hear this afternoon is something of a cross-party consensus on the way forward for housing, both in terms of analysis of what's wrong with the current housing market and then moving towards possible solutions. And I just want to sort of emphasise the figures again, because I think our combined analysis is that we're just not building enough homes, and that is really the root of the housing crisis in this country. So we know that we need to build about 245,000 to 250,000 homes each year just to keep up with demand, but only 125,000 houses were delivered in the last year. So this is leading to huge undersupply. And we know that between 2011 and 2014, the total shortfall against the need for new homes totaled a massive 515,000 new homes. So, I mean, these are, you know, huge numbers. And what this means is that many people who aspire to own their own home aren't able to do that, and that record numbers of young people are living with their parents, often well into their 30s. But we also know that where new homes are being built, they're not necessarily in the right place. And there are major supply issues, particularly in the southeast, where there's high demand for housing, but there's also strong employment markets. And just to pick up your point, Philip, about Liverpool, this is something that we need to think about very, very carefully. And we're obviously not in, we are suggesting there should be more economic development outside of London to also try and tackle some of this problem. But that problem of supply not only means that people can't get access to the housing they want, it also means that there is a huge problem of affordability. Now, this is particularly acute in London, where you're talking about, you know, people having to earn 14 times their salary to get onto the housing market. It's actually a problem right across the country, because even in my Durham constituency, that from a London perspective you might think is very cheap in terms of housing, you're talking about 7.5 times the average salary. The average house price is 7.5 times the average salary. This is just a huge affordability issue in terms of house purchase. But there's also building up a strong affordability issue in the social rent, etc., where they are charging market rents, or 80% of market rents. That's very high, too high for a number of people in some areas. But also, we know that the rent rises in the private rent, etc., are also making it really difficult for a number of people to access and sustain themselves in that sector. So average private rents have increased from £153 to £176 a week between 2008 and 2013. That's an increase of 15%, and over the same period there was a 21% increase in London. So, you know, we really need to look at what can be done to make that sector more affordable as well. And too many people are having to rely on housing benefit to simply be able to sustain themselves in their tenancies. And, of course, this has got a knock-on effect to street homelessness and rough sleeping, because that has increased by 55% in the last 4 years. So I know I'm chucking a lot of statistics at you, but does tell a story of a deepening housing crisis. So, and coupled with that, and I want to say something more about this in a minute or two, is that we're not necessarily getting the infrastructure that should underpin new housing developments to make them really work effectively as communities, and that's a matter of real concern to me. So we want to really, I suppose, challenge the government on a number of issues. The first one is on the basic supply issues and what are they doing to drive up supply. We're not against the extension of the right to buy, but we want to see how it's going to be made workable, and we don't think we're quite there at the minute. We're very concerned about changes to 106 agreements or the watering down of SIL that is reducing the amount of money that's available to local authorities to put into basic infrastructure to support those new communities. And we also think that what's important about not having the appropriate infrastructure is that you don't get community buy-in to new development, because often what people will say is, well, I will ask them sometimes in my constituency or elsewhere, why are you against this new housing development? Oh, pressure on the schools, pressure on the roads, pressure on the local health services. And you simply don't get the buy-in from the community you need unless you're able to address those very fundamental concerns of infrastructure. Now, when we were in opposition in the last government, we actually put together a very, very detailed set of policies around the Lions Review to tackle some of these issues. And there are resonances of that in this excellent report that's being launched today. Because we, again, focused, like I think you are, Philip, on local solutions. And we wanted to think about new homes agencies that would be put together with a local authority, either singly or in combination, that would have wide-ranging powers to be able to drive forward new development in an area. They would have to bring their communities with them. We thought that was really important, building consent right into the heart of that system. But, you know, we are in danger of having a planning system that seems too remote from people even with neighbourhood planning, and that is a good thing. But I still think people feel lots of decisions are made and they don't take the local community on board enough, and I think we have to really address that by having and giving local communities over more say over what happens in their area. And it does need to have wide-ranging powers for land assembly and to look at things like the quality of the housing, whether it reflects local characteristics, whether it's using the climate abatement and carbon abatement measures that we know exist to their full potential. All of these measures that will drive up quality and help get acceptance from local communities of the need for the additional housing that this country really must deliver very quickly. So I think this is a really important contribution to the debate. I'm sort of encouraged by it, and I hope that we can continue it both this afternoon and beyond. And thank you very much.
Oh, no, thanks so much, Roberta. And no,
Sorry, there's just one last thing I wanted to say, sorry, that I'd forgotten to say. We also thought the new homes agencies, in where there was a combination of local authorities or working through combined authorities, could drive forward a new generation of garden cities and urban extensions, because we are not going to get the number of houses that we need without some of those big housing developments and new communities coming forward.
Sorry. No, and you're right to say that it echoes the Lions Review, and Sir Michael's actually on our press release given a very supportive quote to our work and sees this as extending that work. And indeed, I think, as you say, there's cross-party agreement on the need to localise, on the need to include people. Where I think we add particularly is SIL Section 104, I don't think work particularly well. 104 often results in kind of empty playground space that looks a bit odd, that doesn't really add to things. SIL tends to see a drop in applications. It actually helps diminish supply. And that's why we think our land value capture, it could easily be simply in the form of a tariff that developers pay in order to develop, actually might have more merit. But just opening up those points, and doubtless David will speak to that and many more things. Can I introduce David Cowans, Chief Executive of Places for Me? David.
Good afternoon. We talk about the housing crisis globally. Has anybody actually looked up what the definition of the word crisis? Because I have. And it's essentially a point at which an urgent or disastrous situation has occurred, where a major change in direction and decisions must be made immediately, is the definition of a crisis. Now, by my reckoning, we've had said crisis for 30 to 40 years, so maybe we should invent a new word for it, because it isn't a crisis. We're not doing anything about it. We haven't been doing it for decades. And one of the interesting issues is, if we are going to do something about it, we're going to have to do something pretty big, pretty radical, pretty quick. And people aren't very good at that, it seems to me. So we need three bits to the equation, it seems to me. One, we need to rethink the whole notion of housing as infrastructure. I argue quite simply that housing, new areas, be they big, small or intermediate, because we need them all, are infrastructure in which people happen to live. Because nobody talks about the sewage, the water, the power, the schools, everything that a community needs to be a community. We don't want, do we ever, to have large-scale housing developments without a single shop, and we've got them in this country, or a single school, or where everybody needs at least one car to get anywhere, but we have them. So we don't want a solution like that, and my worry about tectonic plate politics is that it all shifts, and then we have to have all this by next Friday, and the system's not like that. And we need to have a very clear consensus that this is a long-term game, not something we can change policy tweaks on and it'll have instant solutions, because it won't. That seems to me to be pretty obvious. I also think that a move towards devolved powers actually needs new frameworks. So I'm a big fan of this approach. I'm not arguing it's the only one. But unless we move to a situation where people take a different view about development. I was a judge on the Richard Wolfson Prize, so I apologise now if you were not a winner. It's my fault, partly my fault. But one of the big issues there was about the economic use of land, because it's the big issue. It's the only real big issue, really. Because if you've got a bit of land that's worth between 10 and 11,000, some places 13,000 agricultural land value, and somebody gives you a certificate that's worth £1.5 to £2 million an acre, in our system, people take that and they go to Marbella normally, or maybe they've got more taste, I don't know. But they take that cash out of the scheme there, and it is lost. And it is no surprise to me, we have the smallest houses in Europe. Yeah. It is no surprise to me that we struggle with the infrastructure because people put it in at the back end, not the front end, because we've got that fundamental conundrum about the land value spectacularly wrong. And I'm looking for a much more entrepreneurial form of local government that actually sees planning permission as an economic instrument. If I go to the local farm and I say, well, I'll give you planning permission, but you're not getting £1.5 million an acre now, forget that now. By the way, the only people to talk to are us. What we'll give you is four times agricultural land value now, an X number of shares in that place for the future, and that's the deal. We'll do it with farmer jails, and we're not doing it with you. That's how it should be done. I recently spoke at a conference of 400 young planners, great thing to see, and I asked them, put their hands up, if any of them had been to a study trip to Northern Europe. Everybody. Did they think that was the way we should be building places of the future? Everybody. Had anybody done that here? Nobody. So I think that's a pretty good straw poll about what's wrong. We're not doing it the way our near neighbours are doing it, and therefore we're getting tiny houses, rubbish infrastructure, year-long planning processes, and we're never going to solve the fundamental undersupply. Never. Unless we renegotiate that tripartite relationship between the development industry, the state, local, and I include local communities in that, and the construction of developments with the landholder being a stakeholder in it. That will never change, that's my view. You always say be controversial, I'm doing my best. Now I'm very happy with better ideas. Now without frameworks like this one, that debate isn't even going to happen. I've come across quite a lot of landholders who are prepared to have that discussion. They get it. It's actually a better return for them really, but no one's put it to them like that. And I think we've lost a lot of our entrepreneurialism in local government, which is a really sad thing. Local government used to be massively entrepreneurial, and they're not anymore. And in a background where the one thing they haven't got is cash, and by that I mean revenue, it's not capital they're short of, it's revenue, their ability to use their commercial skills with the support of local partners, and we're very happy to be those sorts of partners, to turn their assets into revenue-producing assets rather than sell them, is a no-brainer. But nobody's pulling this together. And frameworks like this one, there are others, but this is a good one, could create the background for that sort of debate. That is a fruitful direction for discussion. It's not going to be sorted at central government level. It might be sorted at local government level with support from central government for these sorts of frameworks, but without that tacit nod that these sorts of deals are okay, we won't get anywhere, I think. So that's what I think about the world. The other big issue is about finance. Philip talked about local authority pensions. Absolute no-brainer for this sort of thing. But like most people in the UK, they're terrified of residential development. They don't understand it. We are the lowest country in the OECD with institutional financing and housing. Less than 1%. The next worst performer is 10%. We're rubbish at it. And there's a lot of reasons for it, but fundamentally we aren't shifting it. You talk to an American fund, by the way, the top 50 funds in the world, 48 of them are in the United States, one's in Canada, so that's pretty heavy dominance in North America, right? You talk to them about this and they say, where do we sign? But there's no framework between institutional finance, the sort of deals I'm talking about, and where they invest. They can't even fund affordable housing. Why not? They do it throughout the world, but they can't here. Why not? And we're going to have to really rethink the way we do this stuff, or nothing's going to change. We might be able to tweak a bit while the market's strong. Our history over the last 40 years was tweak a bit, it gets better a bit, the economy turns down again, and everybody pulls their horns in. But at that point, by the way, market rent increases because people buy the stock that the house builders can't sell. That's not really a paradigm I'd like to see much more of. But if the idea is that we're going to achieve this without us changing, it's a facile argument. Have you seen that great slide on Twitter where there's this whole pile of people that says, who wants change? Everybody puts their hand up. And the next question is, who's going to change? Nobody puts their hands up. And that strikes me about where we are. Everybody wants change as long as they don't have to be part of it. And I think we need a national debate using reports like this one. I actually think that Lyon's report was massively helpful. We contributed to it. But it needs to be part of a framework where we all try and create a nexus for that debate. Without it, I don't think we're going anywhere very quickly. That's my point.
Well, thank you, David. And I think we agree with every point you made. I think that the crucial element, I think, that you've identified is land value. As I say, I think we're the only people really to argue for its capture. And I think that, just as you described, we need to strike deals where people don't get 1,000%, but get maybe 250%. And that we create the procurement regime that enables best value to be used for best value. And that actually, perhaps even through the application of the Social Value Act to capital works, we could make something like that possible, which I think is absolutely vital. And of course, capturing this land value, however we do it, is actually what will make this self-sustaining and self-financing. And it's exactly that that will pull in mass international investment, because it's something understood. It's bizarre that the one thing that has done incredibly well in spite of equity markets and everything else is residential housing, and yet we don't have an institutional vehicle for international investors to invest in it. Yeah. It's just peculiar. Just to repeat, the hashtag is UK Housing, if you want to comment on it. I don't know if we've got a Wi-Fi code, team, but if you could let me know, that'd be useful, because my Vodafone has given up working, but maybe your networks haven't. Okay, and now I'd like to move to Jeremy Stive, who's Executive Director at Peabody. Okay. Thank you.
I was going to start off by drawing on something that Roberta and David have majored on, and that's land value capture. And when we started this journey, about a year ago, I think,
yes. Yeah.
My view was very much driven by, it's a London context, is that there are so many areas that are changing around London. The local authority puts a lot of work into making a strategic intervention to turn very suboptimal, low-value industrial areas into high-value, high-density mixed use. And all the money's lost because the agents get involved, the landowners then take the value out of the development, out of the area, and you end up with something sterile and different and not as good as it could be. But actually what we've come up with in the report today that Philip and David have led on is much, much more than that. But that sits at the heart of it and is absolutely vital. Peabody, we're leading on a very significant opportunity area regeneration called Thamesmead. We are a significant landholder there, and the plan is to build 14,000 homes and create 9,000 jobs. So it's a big long-term project. What we looked for to start it off, one of the big problems there is very low values and lack of viability. And we needed some public investment, and there wasn't a lot on the table. There wasn't a lot of structure in terms of making something work. But housing zones came along, and we're now using housing zones to kickstart the first 3,000 homes, which is very good. And housing zones, those of you who know them or are involved in them will know that they've created something which is a better structure, regional and local government working together. It's created ambition for local authorities in areas where they haven't previously had a lot of growth, which has been enormously helpful. And the funding's flexible. And that's the first. So the GLA in London particularly are paying for bridges and infrastructure and things they could never have previously funded. And so all of those things are very good. But it's not enough. And actually what we're suggesting here is some things that deal with the limitations that housing zones still have. And the first of those is how the land market operates. Land assembly is still problematic. Most people will sit on their land and wait for top value and not play part of the partnership in terms of making the land come forward for development. Planning, a second biggest issue, and that's the planning process and the fact that local authorities don't have the resource, but also in terms of how do you capture value that deals with the infrastructure in the financial environment we're in terms of public financing. It's the thing that holds everything back. Now, it's been in the too difficult box for a very long time, but I think what local place partnerships does is unlocks that. And a year ago, I was sitting around the table talking to people about this, and everyone saying, oh, it's been tried before, it's too difficult. Actually, there are a lot of very positive discussions which need this structure. So be it a fixed tariff or a local development order, something that fixes what needs to be done in terms of infrastructure at the beginning, so when the land trades, it trades on the right terms without the agents and people who want to develop bidding the value up or missing out the things that make a place in terms of infrastructure. Housing zones haven't dealt with third party alignment, so that's all the people who are really important, the community and people who aren't directly involved in the development, to make sure it's the right outcome. And then there's procurement, and I've seen in a number of projects the public sector procurement around public land is incredibly complicated. So you put all of those things together, housing zones have been great and have moved the debate on, but actually local place partnerships does a little bit more than that. So the things, I think, just to finish off in terms of what we need to do to make a local place partnership work, from the idea it is today to something real, is firstly this streamlined planning process, something with a fixed tariff or a local development order that fixes what needs to be done to make the place the right development. The second is real community engagement, and I think this is a problem everywhere still. Neighbourhood planning shows local communities a plan. What it doesn't do is engage them before that, and so this is about bringing those people round the table earlier on. Public lands, absolutely vital. What was the statistic? 28%?
I got it. It was the other way around. It's 40. Public sector owns 40% of all developable land and 27% of brownfield land.
Yeah.
So that's enormous.
It's enormous, and it's how does that change to make public land come in a way that doesn't stifle development but actually helps it, and public procurement is a significant part of that. Support for local authorities, and David mentioned this, I think David Roberto mentioned this, they're stripped back, they don't have the resources, so strategic local authority investment is needed. And in the experience I've got directly with some of the projects we've worked with, particularly Thamesmead, you've got two local authorities, one of whom haven't really done this before, and they're really stripped back to just do core services. They haven't got the revenue to pay for strategic intervention, and somehow this needs to help with that, because they sit at the heart of making this work. And then the final thing, simple procurement. I know that things that, years are added to projects around getting procurement right, and if you have to go through a process to select a partner, which is very difficult and adversarial and lots of conditions in it, it doesn't create an environment for two organisations to come together and have the same objectives. It becomes contractual and difficult. So if we can get those things right, local place partnerships really adds value to accelerate growth.
I think that's an enormously helpful, Jeremy, as a list of what we need to tackle. So thank you very much. I was very struck on reading the report, and apparently British homes are 38% smaller than German homes in more dense areas, and 40% smaller than Dutch homes. And the type of add-on costs that you can imagine, the pressures on the family, the fact that children don't have any space to do homework, and so on and so forth. All of this is precisely what we now need to address through institutions like this, that I think should be able to break the minimum standards that are minimal and actually build stuff that we need. So it's great to be able to turn to a developer from the developer side, one of the leading developers in Galliford Tribe, trying to build to a higher standard. So Stephen.
Thank you, Philip, and thank you for your advocacy and the contributions from colleagues in terms of trying to find a desperately needed new approach to housing that I'm sure many of us in the room share. And all of us here today, I think, looking around the room, we've got housing professionals, local authorities, politicians, consultants. All of us are effectively commissioners of housing, whether it's through our personal lives in terms of our rent or buying homes or through our professional lives. We're all involved in commissioning homes. We're all aware of which places thrive, what places are very successful. So for me, the issue today is not about knowing what works. Many of us know how to build great places. Many of us know how to talk about legacy planning. The issue is about removing the barriers that impede supply, that prevent those partnerships being formed. It's about establishing structures and critically the public and private partnerships that are inevitable if we're going to really sustain an increased investment. Partnerships which match public purse and private capital and share risks and rewards. And that's the key. Whether we're talking about land, whether we're talking about the farmer, as David mentioned earlier, seeing the shares grow as a place becomes a thriving community. It's about sharing in that risk and reward, recognising the commercial realities. So what I'd like to do is just mention three key reasons why I think local place partnerships, LPPs, are so important. Firstly, they provide visibility, or will provide visibility, for investment and resources. At Galliford Try, we consider ourselves a responsible investor. We're also a constructor, so we're not only investing in new homes, we're also acting as a contractor in response to commissions. But like all house builders, whether you're a public company, so whether you're a private company, whether you're a PLC, whether you're a registered provider, what you're actually involved in is manufacturing and retailing, not land trading. So the issue when we talk about the value of land is an issue about those who trade in land. It isn't about the people who put one brick on top of another. It isn't about the commissioners of housing. And I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind, that if we come up with structures that capture that value and capture that value to the benefit of supply and the quality of what we provide, there are existing business models out there that are quite capable of responding to that. And like any business, what we need is stability and visibility of a forward market. So bringing together over a 10 or 20 year time frame a long-term partnership of the public and private sector, which allows you to bring your investment strategies to play in an aligned way, allows you to work with local colleges about future labour force, allows you to work with local businesses, allows you to make investments in local markets, is absolutely key. The downside to the model we have is where we see short-term investment and disappear. That is in nobody's interest. And if local place partnerships address that issue, it will have gone a significant way towards helping us provide the sorts of homes that we want in the communities that we need. And that will encourage that focus of resources. It will encourage house builders, it will encourage developers, it will encourage registered providers to collaborate in those area-based solutions. The second thing that I particularly like about the proposals today is that it places local authorities right at the centre of the solution. Now, we've all seen at all of the presentations we go to the graphs which show this enormous steep decline in house building output post-war as local authorities lose their direct commissioning role. So we're all aware of that. But we also know, and we certainly know from our own experience, that some of the best places that you provide, the most award-winning schemes, are where you're looking at collaborations with public and private sector. And in fact, the schemes that we've won awards with, I would say those that have a heavy client input and those which involve public sector commission, are overly represented amongst our awards cabinet, which tells you something about the quality of how those collaborations work. We already work with a range of councils and in very fragile, quite good and very positive markets right away across the country. So as well as working with the GLA in London, we're working with councils directly in Gateshead, in Manchester, in Birmingham, Bristol, Plymouth and Cornwall. A wide range. So there are already examples out there, fireworks of brilliance if you like, where local authorities are able to informed partnerships, formed partnerships, and collaborate in a way which generates risk and reward. This proposal builds on that body of evidence, which was also in the Elphick report, that shows that there are templates around currently that allow local authorities to come forward and galvanise the public and private investment. But at the moment, what they're doing is they're facing some pretty strong headwinds. Certainly, there are issues around procurement, there are issues around in-house resources for local authorities having the capacity to sit down and make commercial decisions. But for me, the biggest issue for local authorities is a lack of a real sense of legitimacy that that's a key role, that's a key area that should be a corporate strategy going forward. We've talked about, as David said, it's not a crisis, it's a catastrophe. It's moved from being a crisis to something else. But it's still not the corporate priority for all local authorities and all collaborative local authorities across geographic areas that it could be. And what's really needed is something that acts as an anchor for that legitimacy, that drives that forward. It's about leadership. It allows mayors, it allows local authorities to come forward with those solutions. And again, if LPPs can legitimise that and help that become a strategic priority, then that's a key issue. I had a phone call this morning from a local authority where we're developing 10 sites in partnership with them, wanting to work with us on buying a site and also wanting to decommission some offices and develop that site for residential housing and a school. And you can have those conversations if you've got a sturdy and trusting partnership in place already. That's a key way of going forward. The third thing, which again has been touched on by Jeremy and David and Philip, is the issue that LPPs will provide a confluence of funding. Really important here that we recognise some very good work that's being done by government agencies, the Home and Community Agency, clearly involved in a lot of infrastructure funding, involved in providing guarantees which encourage investment. But what we really want is to move away from single fireworks of brilliance, single specific good joint venture collaborations, and look at multiple sites, look at scale, which will encourage new investment vehicles to be formed, which will encourage overseas capital that is looking for safe harbour, that is looking for sensible returns, to come forward with solutions. And what will happen is if you're dealing with multiple opportunities within a partnership, people will start to talk the same language of yields, the same language of expectations, the same returns will be seen, precedents will be set. And what that creates is a stable environment to encourage that investment, both equity and institutional investment. And that's what we would, that's what I hope LPPs will encourage. And inevitably, in encouraging that, you will see support not only for the larger players, but you'll see smaller players in the industry being involved through partnership, but also having the confidence to invest if you're a smaller house builder, if you're a smaller registered provider, if you're a smaller local authority, but you're partnering with your adjacent authorities, you've got a different approach. So what I sincerely hope is that what we've described today, which will need more work, which needs more support, which needs to gain more traction as it rolls out, is something that we can stimulate the process for housing supply. And what I'm certain of is that this will provide an opportunity to really address supply, and hopefully it will provide an opportunity to provide quality places in a collaborative way going forward.
Thank you very much, Stephen, and particularly apposite was the idea of a streamlined planning process. And I think one of the things that emerged from our discussions is how fragmented that process is currently or can be, and how difficult it is to actually create a fast turnaround on projects. So, hopefully you're building up with various questions that you want to add to the powers we've described already necessary for the institution. And we'll turn to you after our last speaker, Sarah Bailey, Head of Residential Real Estate at Trials and Hamlets.
Thank you. Well, I'm in a very odd position that I'm not a developer, I'm not a chief exec or a development director, I'm a lawyer, so why am I here? I've actually worked been housing or one from another for over 20 years, and I feel quite old today actually, because I realised that when I first started, shared ownership was a very novel sort of tenure, and now it's regarded as old hat. What's really interesting is over the 20 odd years I've worked in housing, and it is on all types of residential, I've got all types of resi. There's been so many different initiatives, there's been so many different products issued by the different governments and different political parties, all with the right thoughts, all with a heart in the right place to try and actually generate more housing, generate more home ownership of some sort or the other. But none of them have the effect of actually producing the number of housing that we need. And in fact, in some ways, it's been confusing because there are so many different products out there. And great for lawyers, lots of drafting different products, but actually, does it really actually give us a need and actually develop more housing? I don't think it does. So something like the local place partnership is fantastic, because what we've done, in my view, and this is slightly controversial, is I think we have played around the edges of the partnerships for years and years and years. I have acted on so many joint ventures, partnerships, public and private, PPPs, public-private sector coming together in harmony to deliver lots of housing. Actually, there are very few that are genuine partnerships and very few that are genuine joint ventures. I'm pleased to say I work with Madame Lien, because he does do very genuine joint ventures, but it is very difficult, because for a partnership to work, you have got to have fundamental respect for your partner. You've actually got to understand the drivers of your partner. And if you're a private sector partner and you've got to make a profit, the public sector's got to get its head around that. Likewise, a private sector partner's got to get its head around what the public sector needs to deliver. And everyone's got to get its head around that registered providers these days are major developers in their own rights. And everybody has a right to a seat at that table. So you do need to work in collaboration. And this, I think, really helps you do that. It gives everybody a voice at the table. Local authorities have been pillared for a long time. I mean, at the moment, I feel really sorry for them. I'm working for a couple of local authorities where they're still under pressure to cut. They're still under pressure to make savings. But at the same time, they're having to try and deliver more housing. They're trying to have to deliver more services. So again, an ability to hook up and link up with people to deliver more is of vital importance. Procurement, I know, I mean, all my clients loathe procurement, that's the dirty word, but it's not going to go away, I don't think. So I think we all have to accept it's here, and it's in, and not necessarily embrace it, but at least sort of take that big deep breath and accept it. But procurement can work. Is the Sweetwater. That was through a procurement process, dealt with very quickly, I believe, and very successfully. So you can, if it's run properly, procurement can work. And actually, to deliver a partnership of this nature, you will go through some procurement process, but the idea is to make it big enough and wide enough, and you don't have to keep repeating it. So actually, you then have continuity and ability to deliver. So I think there's some really exciting stuff in this framework, and I'm very, very proud to be part of the sponsorship of it, and it's really, really important. I do think housing should be viewed as the national part of the national infrastructure. It's too important, it's too low down the industry agenda. I was at a round table earlier this week with Stuart Lipton, who announced that we should have a housing czar, and there should be a housing czar in each devolved authority. Not a bad idea. I mean, actually, you can see where that was coming from. You can see that someone was empowered to try and force people to deliver it. But again, it's not actually about someone being in partnership, it's almost someone trying to enforce it. And I'm not necessarily sure that will always work. But one of the interesting points that he was raising is that we all talk, there's been lots of talk and lots of reports, and now really it's time for action, and we actually do need to move to that next step.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I particularly like the idea of making partnerships real, and I particularly was struck by your point on not endless re-procuring. We need to create the conditions for genuine partnership, and that's the only condition for going to scale. Okay, over to you. What I'd like is to take questions. I think the best thing to do is take them in groups of three and then let the panelists respond in to the questions that strike them. So first of all, sir, you can just introduce yourself.
Anthony Murray from the Labour Land Campaign. People were a bit vague about this idea of capturing land value. We're talking about a conventional annual land valuation tax, like what Anthony Burnham and Tristram Hunt are talking about, to provide a revenue for a virtuous cycle between public sector investment and land value.
Great question, thank you very much. Sir?
Mark Tite from Chelsea. The student is an excellent reporter, right?
Sorry?
This is an excellent book.
Thank you, I'm glad. I hope colleagues captured that. Thank you very much, Mark.
My question is again on capturing my crowd. It's sort of a cavalcade of characters there in terms of the deals being offered. One of the things we looked at is not using compulsory purchase, using the threat of compulsory purchase to have the stick to make sure that the land that is currently being kind of hoarded, like gold in a dragon's cave, can be freed up for these sort of developments. And I was interested in the panel's views as to what extent they would go down to ensure that land can be released with a little bit of stick about, as well as kind of giving good deals to their own land.
Another great question, thank you. And one more, just behind you. Sorry, sir. Yeah.
John Cain, Anthony Collins, Sisters. Did you consider whether LEPs could be the vehicle for this rather than LPDs creating another vehicle? And if you decided it wasn't the right vehicle, can I ask why?
Fantastic. I'll answer, if I may, the last question and then turn it over to colleagues. I don't think LEPs are a good vehicle. First of all, they vary in terms of their governance and structure, and they have no democratic accountability in terms of direct accountability. What they normally are is a confused mixture of local authority appointments but de facto management capture. Some LEPs work really well, many don't. And LEPs currently lack, though in some areas they have them, land assembly powers. And essentially there's no way under a LEP model that you can create the type of partnerships that we think will go to scale. Why I think it's important to create a devolved new housing institution is what's wrong with this country is nobody seems to be responsible for anything. And that's because we're a late modern, highly developed country with many complex actors. And so nothing happens. So what you get is inertia. So what we need to do is repurpose and recreate institutions. It's why a lot of Res Publica's work on devolution has so much traction, because that's what's required. And we think what's needed in this case is a new institution with devolved powers and real potency. And I don't think LEPs are those. But let me turn it over to the panel. Sarah, you spoke last, so you speak first. Would you like to answer any of those questions?
And I think the CPO ones are interesting. Historically, we have often advised in schemes where the threat of CPO has been reached to try and keep the land value at a sensible rate. And actually, recently, that's dropped off. There's been less use of that CPO power, I think, for local authorities. They've got to be more concerned about losing it. And whether that's a particular concern or they feel like it's a sledgehammer cracking nut, I'm not sure. But at the end of the day, it does work, and it is a power that's been given to them to actually use. So I'm for it, and I think it is one of those things.
Stephen?
Yes, the whole issue of I agree with CPOs should be used more widely. The whole issue of land value capture, of course, is a very, very difficult and tortuous one. Otherwise, people would have been presenting it in manifestos before now. I suspect that unlike some other European countries after the war where land was pooled together for public use, and we now see those local authority equivalents in Europe able to dictate land use, we lost that opportunity. The genie was out the bottle, and so we are where we are in terms of a very fragmented system of land supply. So I think it's very difficult to anticipate that we would go back to or be able to get that. What there are, though, are many mechanisms to allow local authorities to work with landowners to give consents which are linked to value, which would ensure that, as David said, the only chance of getting consent on that land is if the value is taken on a deferred basis and some of it is reinvested. I go back to my statement about being a manufacturer retailer. That's not a problem for me. My business is not about making money out of land. It is about creating homes and making money that way. So from my perspective, if there was a level playing field through the planning system, then that's absolutely fine. I don't have any problem with that, and I think there are mechanisms to achieve that. One of the very great difficulties that exists, and I don't know, I suspect some of you may have heard a recent Radio 4 documentary on looking at this application of Section 106s and how difficult that is. One of the real issues for local authorities is their ability to be engaged in those commercial discussions. The public representatives being able to get alongside the private sector and properly negotiate commercial realities. And that's something that would definitely need to be strengthened in order to achieve a proper tool for land value capture.
Fantastic. Jeremy?
Yeah, I think I'm echoing what people have already said, but I think it has to be simple because it's been in the too difficult box. And naysayers will say it's been tried before and it doesn't work. People don't understand it. So I think the two simple mechanisms to make it work are better use of a simpler CPO system, which means land does trade for development, and a simple planning tariff, which sets a benchmark at the point land trades so people know what they are going to deliver. So both those two things together should create a simple environment. The difficulty comes, London's very high value, North of England's very low value, and there needs to be a mechanism which allows for both of those scenarios, because of course the land that David talked about was very low value. And you know, how do you create an environment which brings it forward? Yeah. And the deferred payment may be a way of dealing with that. I think there's something worth saying around how that value is used. And I think at the moment, Section 106 works on the basis sometimes on-site, sometimes off-site. And there's a lot of money accruing for off-site Section 106 provisions. And there's no real mechanism, as I understand it, to monitor how that's used. And I was at a session a week or so ago, and someone had done some statistics. In London, last year, £300 million worth of off-site Section 106 cash had been generated through development. But actually, it wasn't being monitored, so no one knew actually what it was being used on. So I think when that value is captured, there's got to be a way of making sure that it's actually used for the right purpose.
I think some fascinating remarks already, and you know, we intend to take this work forward. I definitely would like to see compulsory purchase sort of made more explicitly part of what's required. Some further work perhaps on how we could easily, because it's got to be, as Jeremy said, it's got to be done easily. I do like a tariff. I like the idea of a pay to participate or pay to build tariff, and then a smaller recurring one to keep the site in a good state. But you know, we're open, David.
I mean, I don't mind whether it's tax or planning gain. The important point is to get hold of it for something. That's the important issue for me. And I think the problems with forms of taxation-based planning gain is you have to understand what drove the increase in value in the first place. It's appliances. So you have to understand that first. And then the big issue for me is not whether you can capture it, but what happens to it. And the danger, and we've seen this with some forms of planning gain, in having general land value capture, is it can go to support existing revenue programmes, and it won't go to improve the infrastructure. So I think the first point is it's got to be hypothecated to the development, because the fundamental issue here, most of the NIMBYs I've ever met aren't NIMBYs at all. They don't touch my hospital, where can I park my car, my kids can't go to school, folk, actually. And to be honest, I think they've got a really good point, because they don't have a lot of history of people actually delivering on the promises to sort out the infrastructure. And so they distrust that. And they're probably right, too. So I think in a proper proposition where we say, look, what we're interested in is the infrastructure first, and we want to then create places that you'd want to live in so we can build houses, which isn't semantics, it's truth, is a completely different paradigm. And that's more likely to command support than, I'll tell you what, why don't you have 5,000 houses and you might get a little school off back of the profits, which is normally what people say. So the big issue for me is, what drives the value? How do you capture it, and what is it used for? So hypothecation is a really important issue for me. If it's just general into the pot, it either doesn't get spent, and there's lots of examples. The last estimate I saw was 1.4 billion of planning gain and had yet to be spent. What's the point of that? The whole point of it is to make a difference to those people, to the quality of life of individuals in that community, not to simply bolster the accounts of central or local government, I would argue. The LEPS thing, I think, is a good point. And there's a whole history in the UK of reinventing the wheel. let's have a massive reorganisation, let's have a huge, more complicated state structure, when we've got stuff that works. And the linkage between economic growth in an area, land use planning and housing markets is one that's woefully underdeveloped, and it ought to be rapidly developed quickly. And strangely enough, often local government's not the best people to drive that forward, so you do get a tendency, I wouldn't want to stereotype this, but you do get a tendency, those places are economically in need of development, want development, and those places who really should have it because they're economically strong don't want it at all. And that's not a sensible way to operate, and it's not a sensible issue. The big question for me is about what civic leadership's about. Civic leadership should be about the stewardship of that place for future generations, not simply now. So we have a big development, I'll tell you what it is, but we drove many double-decker buses around this development for 3 weeks, with great big signs on the side, where are your kids going to live in 20 years' time? That's the level of traction we didn't get with people, because that got a lot of traction. People said, oh yeah, well, I don't like the idea, I wouldn't get it, but actually my kids will have to leave 15 miles away, which they don't really want. And they do want to live in it, but there isn't any property or it's too expensive. We need to actually deal with these things at a human level, not at a massive master planning level that people don't understand. We need to address these issues in human terms, it strikes me, in order to create a vision for the area within which these decisions about planning make sense.
I think your point about hypothecation is really true. Actually, it shows that support for taxes rise if things are hypothecated. So people support taxes if they know where it's going. And I think that's not just true in this sort of development, but elsewhere. I probably differ from you a little on LEPs. I don't think the evidence is very clear that they're particularly successful at all. And I think that if we are reinventing the British state, and I think we are, we're reinventing it through kind of new forms of institutional creation around devolution. And LEPs, and I repeat the point, have no democratic accountability. It's very, very indirect, and they don't involve, and they're not particularly good at involving places and people. So I think they should be part of the mix, and I think what we're proposing, local planning partnerships, sit well in a devolved settlement. They could sit well under a mayor. They could sit well under a combined authority. But I think we need housing-specific institutions. Anyway, second round of questions. So,
Nick Salisbury, Social Finance. I'd really just like to develop what David was saying about how do you actually give the impetus for local authorities to actually take the action? Because, as we said, a lot of that entrepreneurship that we found with the housing zone, certainly in London, that while some a lot of authorities really embrace that sort of money here on offer, a lot of them didn't either apply or got very low ambition. And it's so it's an even playing field, so it's not just those authorities who have a sort of government mindset to provide the housing. A lot of the other authorities who have land are not doing very much. How do we get them into the mix?
Very good point. Thank you very much. Another point. Sarah in the back.
Week was from the Hospital Association. Since local authorities maintain a group partnership for the largest house builders, the DCSE is playing a different role in tackling the supply and placemaking issue.
So can you say that again?
Seeing as local authorities maintain better partnerships with the largest house builders, do you see the SMEs playing a different role in tackling the supply and placemaking issue?
Fantastic. Yeah, fantastic question on SMEs. And the last point. Well, we've got two. If you just hold your point, sir, and we'll come back to you for the third round. The gentleman right at the back.
Yeah, hello. My name is Jerry Unsworth from the District Councils Network. We've been working recently with the Planning Officer Society, the RTPI, on how we can improve the sort of local, the regulatory, without going to primary legislation, regulatory framework to encourage sort of strategic planning, because you might think that individual districts may be part of the problem, but actually they're being saddled with sort of very difficult working arrangements under duties to cooperate and so on. So we are working together to try and see how the situation can be improved. And I suppose my question, that's just information, and it's very imperative to be talking to DCLG about how we can improve the regime. But my question is, whether the panel has got any specific measures that they have got in mind to improve the way that plan-making end of this works, because I think the techniques you're talking about are very, from a personal point of view, very welcome in terms of delivery, but whether there's any thoughts gone into how plan-making system can improve the sort of strategic delivery of housing.
Just because, could you, your question suggests you have an idea about how that might be done. Would you care to share it with us? Because I think that would help the panel inform the answer to your question.
Well, we've been looking at how the individual authorities can collaborate on strategic plans, and how the how that perhaps could be the only plan that an authority prepares, that they may not go down into great detail, but that there is a greater imperative to sort of collaborate strategically. We're also looking at how you can break down the examination process of the plan, because it can be a sort of snakes and ladders that you get to the end to find out what it writes, so how you can deal with certain building blocks of strategic partnership working earlier in the planning process.
Fantastic, thanks very much. Jeremy, you don't have to respond to them all, just the questions that strike you.
Creating ambition in local authorities, I mean, I think housing zones has created more ambition than ever before in London, in my context, particularly in that bit of outer London where local authorities didn't have a high level of growth. It has created a start of a conversation around being more ambitious. We're at an early stage with all of those projects. It's difficult to see exactly how that will turn out. But I do think the ambition's there. And so the idea of local-based partnerships is a set of tools and a structure to give people confidence. And both RTPI and TCPA, if I've got those both right, the planning organisations do quite a lot of good work around helping people go and see projects and large-scale regeneration to get them into the mindset. We're working with Bexley at Thamesmead, who really haven't done growth before, and we're talking to the members and taking them and showing them things around what growth means. So I think it's not an immediate quick fix. I think people are starting to get more ambitious. It will take some time, but structures like these are absolutely vital. SMEs play an absolutely vital role and are under engaged, if that's the right phrase. House builders dominate, large house builders dominate. We're not talking about house building per se, we're talking about placemaking, and developers and SME developers who understand the local politics are vital. I don't know what the answer is. Certainly cheap forms of finance, which the government have tried to do, is a way of helping that, but I still think it's a bit too restrictive. And certainly some of the interest rates the HCA were looking at, because they represent a bigger risk, was prohibitive. So I think finance is an issue. But this is a way of drawing those people in, those local people who lose out. They do a lot of hard work, and then one of the big developers or big house builders will come in and take it all. So absolutely vital. Sorry, I've not got the answer. I think planning is obviously the key to it. And I think it's about more resourcing. I think the local authorities I see are stripped back to core services. We've been to see a number of things in Europe. We were in Holland in a new town called Almere, just outside Amsterdam, and we met the planning team there. The guy who leads it was talking to us about placemaking and the things that he's put in place around creating real new communities. And I had to ask him what he did again, because he sounded so unlike any planner I've talked to in this country. And it was really refreshing to see him. But you have to invest in it. And I think local place partnerships are around how do you invest in that revenue to make it work. And again, probably not an immediate quick fix. I think that's probably the heart of it.
I mean, if you see in the report, what we have is a grid that compares the local place partnerships to urban development corporations and housing zones. And I think you can see from that we believe local place partnerships are much more flexible. So on SMEs, we argue for bespoke forms of financing and bespoke forms of commitment to them in terms of procurement to enable them to grow and foster further growth, because many of the smaller sites are really only suitable for SME developers. Sarah?
Yeah, and I think on the local authority one, and that's, it is really interesting, is that I'm not sure it's a lack of ambition. I think that some local authorities have some, they've maintained a skill set, so they're able to actually go out there and start delivering. And London Borough of Enfield's just launched Meridian Water Regeneration, and that shows real ambition, and it shows a real strategic approach to how you can actually deliver potentially 8,000 new homes plus 3,000 jobs. So that's real ambition. There are other local authorities who I think it's more a little bit of fear from the politicians, because I've got some very good officers who want to deliver things, but actually the politicians are scared of delivering it. So at the end of the day, you've got to get the politicians with you. So it's how actually you sort of de-risk it and show them it's not something terribly scary, that actually they can do it, and maybe you start small and get bigger. On the SMEs, I mean, I think there are ways around it, not just with the funding, but I think there are the developers out there who bring SMEs in to developments. Again, there are big regeneration schemes where part of the requirement is to make sure SMEs are actually brought in and actually deliver a certain amount, even if that's slightly subsidised by the big boys. So there are ways of doing it. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a way of making sure the SMEs are sitting at the table. I'm afraid I'm not a planner, so I'm not going to comment on the planning.
Yeah, Stephen, you want to comment?
I was going to give a quick comment on all three questions. So firstly, on the issue of local authorities and the lack of uniformity about those that are prepared to engage, I think there is a role here for central government to introduce carrots and sticks, capital programmes, doesn't have to be massive, which will be time related and which will encourage local authorities to bring forward solutions and get engaged in sweating the assets they've got and looking to collaborate in taking the ways forward. Not just in the model that we've presented here, but I think nothing makes town halls leap into action like the idea of a time related opportunity to get access funds. If that helps to resource local authorities, because that's the big part of the issue. They'd like to do things, but they haven't got the capacity. And it goes back to my earlier point, it's actually enfranchising local authorities in a sense, saying to them, this is what you should be doing, this is what you can do, and these are mechanisms that you can use, rather than sitting back and sitting in the too difficult pile. So that would be my approach for local authorities. In terms of SMEs, it's absolutely fascinating, because I think SMEs are vital part of the solution. They're about where people learn their skills to go on and develop. There is a lack of, everybody talks about there being a shortage of plumbers and bricklayers, there is a severe lack of people in the intermediate and senior positions within the house building industry in order to adapt to an increasing capacity. If you take, it's a shame John's gone, I was at a meeting with some other house builders recently and we had a question, how many of you have lost good staff because they've gone off when conditions are benign to start up their own SMEs? It's always been the traditional route, people would work for large house builders, they'd go off. Nobody in the room knew of the loss of any staff who had been prepared to go off and make the investment, take the entrepreneurial risk. They were devout entrepreneurs, but within an existing business, not going off and doing something on their own. So something is wrong about the way in which we are supporting the growth of SMEs. And I think they're absolutely fundamental to the part of the solution. And I think what Sarah was alluding to is there are examples, and we're involved in some ourselves, where working with smaller house builders, smaller developers, you're able to present something to a public commissioner in a more integrated way, which works. And then finally, on the issue of plans, I would say, yes, please, let's get some plans in place first. Because for me, planning is, yes, there's a bit of gatekeeping, but planning for me is about encouraging investment. That's the fundamental purpose of planning. It should be about encouraging investment in all its forms, investment in quality communities. And you wouldn't begin to embark upon a platform of investment without a plan. So what we really need are spatial plans in place in all local authorities with very clear strategies, with presumptions of which areas will be developed in what way. And I think that would certainly give the momentum to where we need to be.
Thank you, Stephen. David?
Big issue for me around the whole plan-making proposition is that there are lots of techniques for doing it, But if the motivation is not within the political body of the organisation, it won't do it. And often it will become resistant to all forms of development. So there's all the training's the wrong word for it, but there's an educative process about, if you have a problem about transport or you're worried about employment, actually there are ways of doing this. And they're called planning your neighbourhood. And people don't see it like that. And I'm on a big campaign, and I think this is a huge issue for us, but planning should be a verb, not a noun. It should be something you do. And that's the big difference between Northern European cities and ourselves. Their planners are planner developers. They're planning in order for it to happen, not planning in order for it not to happen, or it to take 20 years to happen. And that's the biggest mindset difference. And the best local authorities already do that, to be fair. And there's not enough trade across. We've started going to the Local Government Association conference, not because it's a great day out, but because we think there's a good prospect of sharing that sort of knowledge and views among local authorities. I have to say, there's a hunger from people about how do you do these things? What are the techniques you can use? And they're better off learning from each other, to be honest. So the very best people, we won the Sweetwater Development in the London Legacy Development Corporation, a really good example of a multi-authority, you could argue it's a local planning proposition. It works really well. We're building 1,500 new homes right in the centre of the Olympic Park in partnership with Balfour Beatty. And the key point about that planning proposition, it needs to be linked to the ability of the local authority to tender propositions. The best do this already. So if you're short planners or you haven't got a placemaking capability, you tender it. You say we at Enfield are doing this. Milton Keynes have done it. Aberdeen have just done it. So you tender a problem and you say, we've got this problem and we'd like it to look like this. Come and tell us how your end position is, you can say no. But it really gets people next to the nexus between planning as an ethereal activity and stuff happening that will benefit the local people. And I think we need to be on a campaign about these things. I'm delighted you're doing it, by the way, because I think it's a very important activity. Anything we can do to help, you need only shout. If we can do that, it'll engage the best of them. The best of them will seek to encourage everybody else. And then the mechanisms we can more readily spread, because I think there's a hunger for it. What there isn't is a lot of knowledge about how to do it.
Fascinating. Thank you so much. I'll do the last round of questions and then we can break and chat to each other. So there was one there, sir, there was you and the lady here. We'll start with you, madam. Thanks. Thank you very much. Gentleman behind you.
Yeah, Richard Whiskey, Nottingham City Homes. In Nottingham, we're not building any houses, but we are building over 700 homes and investing in excess of £90 million. And the reason I make the distinction between houses and homes is because we talk a lot today about large-scale house building. And it's not new, large-scale house building, but it's before this country. So we've ended up with the smallest houses in Europe. Quite rightly pointed out earlier. Within Nottingham, we made a conscious decision to look for long-term sustainable communities by building houses 8-10% bigger than the sort of standards that are available. Minimum building regulation standards, minimum HGA space standards, and density standards are still to find definition of low density, find definition of high density. And what all those things bring, when you look at cost-quality models, in terms of building homes that people want to live in for a long period of time, is the conflict between investments in yield and the actual quality of the homes that you're building. And I was just interested in, within this partnership, how would to manage the tension between that cost, demand, and sort of quality model that's essential if you're not going to carry on building a small challenge in the future.
Great question. Thank you very much. And then we had a couple of others. Sir, right at the back. That's great. Thank you very much. One more question from anyone? Or are we good? I think we're good. Okay. Colleagues, we'll go from right to left. So, Sarah, do you want to... Again, you don't have to answer them all, just the ones that strike you.
I mean, for me, the one that strikes me is working across borough, because I mean, that's been talked about for so long. And it happens in certain services. In certain services, you've got local authorities coming together to actually produce those services. But when it comes to something as maybe as a motive as housing or as redevelopment or regeneration, it seems to fall down. And I think something like this framework actually does help, because it's not just two local authorities having to work together, their politicians having to agree, and maybe different political tensions, and there may be office issues. If it can be formed within some form of organisation or partnership, then actually it becomes a bit easier. So to me, that actually really would help. It would help take the spotlight, perhaps, of absolute individual local authorities and allow them all to take part of the table without it being as obvious.
No, well, I mean, one of the inspirations for this institution is cross-borough working. And that's why we want it to be about places, because places, Ebbsfleet, for instance, is across three or four different county boroughs. So that's why we called it places. Precisely so it can create the cross-borough working.
Very negative, really, about the housing crisis or catastrophe or whatever we call it. But we're actually, I mean, I've got a French client who tells me they're brilliant at delivering housing in France. They're excellent. They deliver it quickly. It turns around in 3 months. They go to planning. They've got to be on site. They've got to deliver. They are not good at placemaking. They think we are a lot better at placemaking than they are. So it's not all bad. No, we actually are quite good at it. It's just we don't do enough of it. And I think that's what's been captured as well.
David.
The procurement point's a really interesting one. I just want to broaden out from your question, really. What a state isn't very good at is preparing for the procurement. So, and I remember this about 1,000 years ago when I was first doing CPOs. People would announce a CPO, the next day the speculators came in, bought it out of the land. Who got the benefit? It wasn't the state. Now, if the state arranged an arrangement where, with trusted partners or itself, that it had required the land, I think that's entirely legitimate. And then you declare the CPO. And housing zones were a bit the same. So if the state's action, whatever it might be, generates potential speculative gains, the state should move in to get it first. And it's terrible at doing that, in all its guises, central, local, whatever it is. So another issue for me is being clear on what it is you're seeking to procure. So a lot of local government, and the best ones do this, I'm not trying to stare at it, but the state generally can over-specify some things, so it's down to the camber and the quality and the colour of the paperclip at one level, and then, some sort of massive warship, and that's it, on a piece of paper. And we're not good at working in a way a lot of European countries are, between industry and the state, to help each other specify what's required so that you get the best of both worlds. I think that's an issue by housing standards as well. So we have building regulations, which should be minimum standards, and the one word nobody's used in this discussion is consumer. These places are people to live in. You know, I work for an organisation called Places for People. And the last people who get asked about anything are the consumers. And we don't construct a housing market either in terms of production or the means of finance focused around the individual. And we operate 9 different products, from social rent right out outright sale, and we allow people to go up and down to tenure depending on their circumstances. That's bog standard marketing. It's and, not more than that.
And what local place partnerships would want to do, what I would like to see them do, is have autonomy to say, well, what's our vision? Do we want these awful, small, tiny houses that as soon as people are in, they want to escape from? No, why we want residents and civil society on these groups is they will have the ability to do maximal standards. And so the social gain that you might capture might not be money, but might be better quality homes that are larger. Absolutely. And deliver for larger families or whatever, or are more beautiful, or have more green space. You know, you can cash out the value you capture in multiple different ways. And I think that's part of the vision, just as is with Respublica's devolutionary work, is create something that's bespoke to the area that lets people define it. I mean, I would even like certain areas to decide on the vision or the look or the aesthetics of the development. That would be wonderful. That's kind of what we want to create, and a sort of mass bespoke, if you will. Jeremy.
I've got just a couple of points. On cross-borough working, it is quite difficult. A lot of big places are spread across more than one local authority. Thamesmead has two, Old Oak Common has four, and David's mentioned one was a number. So it's a real issue. And previously, the answer has been is create a UDC, create something that has planning powers outside the local authorities that takes it away from them. And I think, you know, whilst in very big projects which need to be delivered in a certain time, that's important. What local place partnerships does is create that environment and structure to enable local authorities to have the confidence to align themselves with other local authorities. You know, in the case of Thamesmead, one's Tory, one's Labour. And so we're aligning that housing zones come some way to do it, but actually local place partnerships are the way to do it. And coming back to Jonathan's point around what are the fruits?
I think partnerships with teeth, and what would the fruits of them be?
That's what I said at the beginning, but I decided not to say it.
Yeah.
But it's you know, there are a number of things that need to happen in terms of making them work, and I gave a list of them. I think if we got one thing out of it, it would be a simple land value CPO tariff system that would give borrowers the confidence that when they go through this really hard work and really have ambition, it's not all lost in the process.
No, perhaps. One of
that's the big thing. That's why I've started
it. You know where a report's going well, where more ideas keep coming up but that you want to do further work on, and that would be something coming up with exactly that tariff. Stephen.
Yep. I think some great couple of questions there. I should have added a fourth thing about what I would like, why I'm supporting LPPs, which would be that I can build bigger homes. Because as Philip's absolutely right, part of what this is about is finding a common language, a common vision of what it is that we're calling to be built. And the tension absolutely exists about the number of homes versus the quality. And I see that as I work with different housing associations. Some say, well, we're building so many homes and we only want five patio, five paving slabs outside. Others say we want a proper 20 paving slabs outside. And it's all about how much you want to invest in which homes. And those are decided by their boards, by whatever governance they have. I totally support the idea of building bigger homes. If I build bigger homes, my housing association clients, my local authority clients, and the people who buy my homes will be much happier. So why wouldn't I want to build bigger homes? And if that is able to be achieved because we're managing land value carefully, then so be it. That's absolutely the right solution. So that's I'd like to come to Nottingham with this model and start applying, could be my answer to you on that one. In terms of local authority collaboration, again, I think that's what this is about, facilitating. It's about saying we're not just constrained by local authority boundaries. What we're looking for is representation from local authorities, from local businesses, from local stakeholders people within the community who will not just work to narrow local authorities' boundaries, but are prepared to look at markets as a whole, are prepared to look at land use as a whole outside of those barriers. And then I come back to it's probably very unfashionable to say this, but there are all sorts of ways in terms of managing, monitoring and looking at outcomes from European funding, from single regeneration budget funding, from Homes and Communities Agency and other public sector funding. So one of the things I would like to see, going back to the question about how do we see what comes out of it, is we should be looking at ways of measuring the output from LPPs, both empirically as well as in terms of what they can achieve politically.
Now, one of the things we've suggested at Res Publica, and I think it is a very good idea, the two aren't necessarily connected, of course, there they seem to be, is that we need a single performance matrix for a whole area. You know, when we were doing work in Manchester on the Greater Manchester Settlement, we got to 1,200 different performance indicators for expenditure going into the Greater Manchester area, and we stopped counting. And what we believe is needed is something like as simple as you know, 10 performance indicators of which LPPs could play a role, and you judge everything in respect of that. But look, we've had a wonderful debate, many questions. Do come and chat to us. We'd like to continue this work. I'll ask Brandon Lewis if he'll do a round table on all the issues that we've brought together. We'd like to go to party conferences with these events, and we'd like to build on these ideas. So come and chat to either me or my colleagues, and I'd like to thank you all very much for coming to Res Publica's events. We've got a number of party conference events coming up that are half funded, so if you'd like to go but only want to pay, would like to partner, we're talking about partnership to get there, come and talk to us. Thanks so much, everybody, and can I thank once again our partners for supporting this work. It's all available free to download. I'd like to thank David Fagelman. Where are you, David? He's hiding. So there he is at the back, sort of. Thank you very much, and well done. And thanks, everybody. Thank you. A round of applause. Thanks for our panel. Say that. We'd love you, you know, if you came out and said you liked it. No, I mean, it matters. This is how you get kind of the debates.
It's very good. Yeah, it's actually, like, you can focus on kind of mapping out the bits against the actuality quite a lot, which is
Oh yeah, well, we'd love to. You've got all our contacts. I get to. I'm coming round to chat. I'm not being rude. It's just difficult. Sort of yelling over a thing.
Thank you. Lewis Johnson, the RLCS. All right, I understand you're a member.
Thank you.